So, if you're writing about your experience in prison, let's get the costume, the cup, the cops, the judge. Let's put that all together and weave that to give people a visual of what you're rapping about. So, challenging you to a higher level. So, can you live your story and show your story?
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, everybody. It is your host, Sharon Smith of Iambic Podcast, and we are here with the author, legend, spoken word artist, keynote poetry word artist, leader, a follower, and now a director of his own play. I'd like you to introduce you to Michael Ellis, or they call the Incredible Poet.
Hey, somebody's been reading my Facebook. thank you. It's good to be here, Sharon.
No doubt. Hey, thanks for coming out. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for coming out and stuff. And just from that even from that introduction, I'm looking at it. You have so much. Just from looking at your little first article of you writing your first poem and actually getting into a contest and stuff in Los Angeles, till just right now of you doing. Directing your own poetry play,
right? Exactly.
What I mean, should we even start from the start? What was that first thing that got you into poetry?
Well, going back to LA,
I'm back to LA. Yes,
trip over something, or it could fall on your head. Mm-hmm. And I think poetry fell on my head.
Okay.
And when you're in a village, and everybody says that you have this talent, whether you want it or not, you start to adopt it. And every time I wrote something, it became a conversation piece.
Okay.
So I was picked up by a prestigious university for writing on a writing scholarship.
Nice.
And at that time, I was compared to Langston Hughes, which was, at 17, I was, well, who is he? Like, I guess. But if that would get me into an expensive university, I would get on the train and be Langston Hughes as long as it got me out of South Central L.A.
Oh, so you're from South Central L.A.?
Yes.
What part?
South Central L.A. near USC, the Coliseum, so the good part.
Okay, so not Crenshaw.
No, not Crenshaw. No, not, that was a few blocks away. That's how that worked out.
But so you got out of that, went to university, started doing things in the university, writing more in books and also the poetry contests and stuff?
Right. And that's where the book, they wouldn't let me be white. I had worked so hard at that, at being white. This is the concept of the book. And I studied frost and the birch trees and sequoias.
Uh-huh.
And so I was getting out of South Central L.A. one way or another. No more ambulances, no more police cars. So when I went to this university, there were, I think, 10 black students in the entire university. It's private. So I thought I was going into the assembly halls to be frost, and they gave me the shock of my life. Like, no, we want Langston. And so that was just the reality that, so it was shocking reality.
Okay. So, well, yeah, I can see that being so it was basically a culture shock, being that were you one of the few black people in the school?
Yes, and the only African-American male who didn't have an athletic scholarship in the entire university. So,
but that's an achievement. Right,
yeah,
there.
That was a shock. And, and so, yeah, that was definitely a shock. I went to that school, leaving L.A. But it was a lesson about leaving home and trying to escape a reality.
Right.
Only to find yourself in a different reality.
Oh.
So I needed to learn that lesson.
So you just point out they didn't want me to be white, but you also had the book before that, which was The Birth of the Blues.
Birth of the Blues, I was writing dialect poetry at 17.
Okay.
Because my grandparents, who I lived in a house with, were 70.
Okay.
And the church was 70. Everything was 70 around me.
So you
pick up this Southern voice and culture, and it just became this thing inside of me. Where I could write 30 or 40 years ahead of myself.
Right.
So that became the shock when I was 17. Like, you know, where do you get this? This is Langston, you know. a rebirth, as they thought it. So they put that weight on me to carry that torch. And it was too heavy. I would learn 10, 15 years later that it was, sometimes it's fair and sometimes it's not fair to put that on a 17-year-old child and to say, go, be famous, be Langston.
Most definitely. Most definitely. But you took that weight, and so far you carry it, has brought you into other avenues and stuff. I mean, even the avenue of you having two books by that time, and then you champion your They Don't Want Me to Be White book for a long time. And even in, I even heard you did it here in Sacramento Poetry Center for quite a while, just pushing that book itself just to every place you knew you can get to. And then from there, you also started Keynote Poetry. And Keynote Poetry, you basically, as I read, it is basically you're trying to get people, you're trying to get chapters and everything. Right. You're trying to get those chapters set up to hear it, even in Africa and stuff, to be ready, just like keynote speakers, be ready on the spot.
Right, keynote poet is always ready.
So tell me more about keynote. We talked about it before, but I want the viewers to know what about keynote poetry is still there, and also the evolution of it, because it now has moved on to something different.
I came to Sacramento after my mother died. I came back to Sacramento in 1991, I believe. And what I saw in poetry then was two colors, black and white. This Mason-Dixon line, and there was really nothing in between. And so I thought about that. This is a problem. We're going to change that. And so I started to really meddle with the culture. And so when I first started doing shows, I think we did the one in, was it Barnes & Noble on Sunrise? And then we opened up here. Bob Stanley gave me the keys to the Sacramento Poetry Center for a year. So we had three or four homes before we settled. And my goal was to, as I brought in these speakers, I was just going through the geography book. I wanted Hispanic. I wanted black. I wanted urban. I wanted ghetto. I wanted, gay. I wanted every religion. And so when people started seeing this, I said, what is he doing? And then the audience started to be diverse as well. And it caused basically a culture shock in Sacramento when they looked at the videos to see in those days, like, what is the source of this poetry venue? Is it a black venue? Is it a white venue? They couldn't really put a demographic on the poetry, which means it's harder to bring down, because who's the leader? I mean, and I never acted as a leader. I just went and gathered the people and did the poetry. So it caused a shock saying that we could all do poetry. And that's what it grew as. So I was shocked myself that it grew so quickly, because we had pretty much four rooms, usually a month or two after we opened the doors. And so that shocked me, is because I didn't know myself. I was so lonely and private. I didn't know me. So I just opened up a venue, and next thing you know, it was packed with people. So that was just really, no one was more in shock than I was. But I wanted all of us to, because I love poetry more than I do the sociology that comes around, is involved with it.
Really?
Yeah. Poetry is the first child.
Okay.
And so when people put the colors and demographics on it so much,
right,
you lose the art itself, I think. So that's what I wanted to.
I never thought about that. You're right. I mean, poetry just the vehicle, but what people put in the car or the vehicle,
right,
that's what people start labeling and stuff. If you put so many different diversity, if you diverse it, it looks a little different for people to go, okay, wait a minute, That's a black car,
right?
That's the black Bentley right there,
right? So I
can see your point of that. It being not the vehicle itself, any poetry, music, or anything, it can be the vehicle, but it's always the people who label the vehicle
right.
that gives it the discretion of, well, we're not going to buy that car because that's what black people drive.
Right.
Or that's what white people, or that's what Mexicans drive. We don't want to.
Right.
And then that's when the discrimination of other things come in. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And there's no word called, I know you have what's called bicultural, where
yeah.
when I write poetry, I can go in an all white audience or an all black audience and not wink an eyeball. Because I can write academic poetry, and then I can switch to urban poetry. I'm well received by both audiences. I did notice that other African Americans weren't, sometimes because of what they write. And I would see sometimes African Americans in the back of the room in a corner, like that, you know, alienated, like, oh, can we talk to people? And I wanted to, you know, get rid of that spell as well, that you don't have to be afraid to come up forward. There's no more standing on in the back of the bus of poetry. And likewise, when I went to an all-black venue, I would see white people in the corner like, is it safe? Is it all right to come forward? And since I was in both worlds, I was in a position to fix both sides of that divide.
So do you feel now that you are still able to hold that divide, or do people sometimes use you so they can get into those places? Like, you're like, oh, Let's use Mike. Mike knows how to get into that place. We'll use him to get in there, and then we'll follow him and stuff. Or do they mostly see that now?
I'm a ghost in poetry. And this, when people wonder why I survive, that's because I really never announce where I'm going, when I'm leaving. Just watch a venue near you, and I might, you know, pop in and, you know, and it's, where did he go? And so I've done that pretty consistently through many venues. Because when you start to develop this popularity, you have this bullseye target on you. So I've always been able to keep the longevity going by being obsolete as much as possible. So one miracle a month, and then that's it.
Okay.
So kind of.
So speaking of that, speaking of one miracle a month, so you started the Keynote Poetry in 2014. So is Keynote, I know you stopped it in 2019. Is it like on hiatus right now, or just that?
No, Keynote's never stopped. It stopped in Sacramento.
Okay.
Because we had a chapter in Africa, Botswana.
Yes.
That was still going.
Yeah.
And then we did the Keynote International Anthology.
Oh, okay.
Where writers from five different continents were online.
Okay.
Contributing.
Oh, okay.
So I mentor people from three or four different continents all the time.
Oh.
All that is a body of work under Keynote. When I taught in a prison, that was Keynotes. When I teach in the school, which I currently do, that's Keynotes. So everything I do is under that umbrella of healing with poetry. So there is no end to, might be into a venue, but there's no end to
Keynote itself.
And even the theater project we're doing now is back to Keynote.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Keynote is you, basically. You're
right.
The face of Keynote. Okay.
Right, and I wanted, when I say Keynotes, when you have the Keynote speaker.
Yes.
I call the Keynote poets because I wanted poets to have that same kind of presence that speakers have. So it was about how you present yourself, presentation, how do you hold an audience, and if Obama called you tomorrow, could you show up and deliver?
Right.
So I've been called to memorial services, to prison. So it's just, you should be able to go anywhere, even a theater.
Yeah.
So that's what the whole thing about being a Keynote is, stepping up your grade to go anywhere.
And speaking of being stepping up your grade and stuff, you had a change. You went from, I knew you back from as the poet ME,
right,
to now the incredible poet,
right?
So what, so tell me about that change. Just like you said, another evolution of Michael Ellis just going into the next phase of his life, or what?
Michael Ellis was becoming three people. One was the rap and the hip-hop, the Tupac generation, which I did pretty well. Street rap. Then I had the academic side, the Harvard, Yale type of poetry. So then you have the gospel in the middle type of poetry. So Incredible had to kind of separate the two characters, because when I do the faster type of poetry, I usually introduce myself as Incredible. You know, when if I'm at a college or somewhere like that, I will use the Michael Ellis. So that was just to distinguish, because it gets very confusing being Tupac and Frost, you know, in the same week, and then you're switching to, it's just such a divide. So I had, and for my own sake, I had to realize that I'm doing two different art forms.
Even that, are you still a member of the Word Wizards?
The Word Wizard, yes, I'm associated with them as well, and I've done several projects with MASH and Word Wizards. And that really helped me because being with poets much younger, or rappers, again, it gives you the speed. It gives you a whole different intensity when you're, you know, moving your head to perform. So that was an adventure in itself. But it all creates a package. And leaving high school, I wanted to be, I always say that I can write in 12 different genres of art. I had a movie script that I submitted, and by the Screenwriters Guild, that was accepted. A novel, won awards, poetry, hip-hop, so all of these different genres, to be able to do them effectively, was a goal of mine. Could I pull all of these things off successfully? And so now we're talking about the play and the, directing the play. I just have to keep, trying a different genre of something to pull that off.
And let me be honest with you, you're pulling off something that even I'm surprised as a poet is going into. I mean, I've seen poets change maybe avenues, like maybe from poetry to music, or even poetry to performance dance and stuff. But you're doing just like what Slam Poetry, the movie Slam did, you're making a play.
Right.
Tell me about this play you are doing with When I Get Free.
Yes. This is when somebody tells you, I have a theater and you can use it. So first I was thinking, what in the world? I was looking for a place to do open mic. And I'm like, what in the world would I need a theater for? And then just like that, it hit me. Like, we can't do an open mic in there. So I said, what if the poets that Jabri Anderson, for example, has been with me since I taught a class in them. I think it was an adult finishing program. So I went there, and then Cloudy I met in high school when I was teaching there. So people that I teach in high school, even though I leave the organizations, they start to stick up with me. You know, students follow you. Ube Cool, whom I met in when he was on probation, he came into the venue. They sent him to us. So it's a beautiful thing when you're moving, the people that, come in with you move with you. So that was a perfect, avenue to incorporate these young people, that were following my work, to mix hip hop and poetry. And I would be the writer that, crafted and weaved it, of course, but they would do the performances. And a great opportunity to help young people make some extra money for their work, which is vital because it's not enough money circulating for poets and artists and hip hop people. So that was a main concern, so.
But you basically have now shown them another light.
Right.
There's always been that little line in some things like literal poetry and even slam poetry, even theater, performance-wise, there's always been some kind of a line. It's poetry, but people always look at it as, oh, well, we don't do that, or right. We don't do this, or we don't do that. But I've seen you're a literal poet that's doing a theatrical play. So basically you're doing theater poetry for the theaters so you're basically now just maneuvering into just other areas that still have poetry but are still able, we're able to do anyway.
I think it's saving several different genres at the same time because parts of hip hop, there's trouble there. There's a decline there. There's a decline in poetry. And so when you mix these elements together, they become more powerful. When you take the hip-hop artists, because I've been to some local shows, they're dark. You have so many artists, and everybody does their thing, and nobody remembers, who was that? I don't know. I mean, by the time you get to the car, you forget all of the 12 artists that you saw. Yeah. It's just really, there's nothing there to stick. When you're on a stage, in a prison costume with handcuffs on, and you're reading your poems, then people will, wow, that's... they'll remember you in the supermarket. So if you're writing about your experience in prison, let's get the costume, the cup, the cops, the judge, let's put that all together and weave that to give people a visual of what you're rapping about. So challenging you to a higher level. So can you live your story and show your story? And also, can you perform in front of an audience of not just of the people that usually listen to your music, but can you perform to a diverse audience? And that is the challenge. you know, and it's going to give them a second light. For example, I had a nephew who all he knows is, you know, the street side of a rap. So now you're on a stage and nobody in the audience is pretty much from the streets. So this is your money that you're not getting, because these people will buy your products, you know, if you do your part and make a decent product. This is money you would never have seen before. The doctor, the lawyer, the teacher, you know, of all different races. So your demographic is so limited. If you're hip hop and your whole audience are all, you know, artists, they're not buying anything from you because they want you to buy their products. So, you know, and that's just a part of marketing as well. You know, you need, and I also say that hip hop affects, say, 5% of the population by hip hop music. So you have the other 95% that want to buy some hip hop music. And it's just a gold mine, and nobody is stepping out of their comfort zone to, you know, reach a different demographic. And so, yeah, and some people are afraid to go into those venues, you know, where it's just intimidating. I'm not going in that venue because so this creates a neutral zone, this theater, where everybody can come and have a, you know, be something that they want to be differently. And it'll be videotaped, of course, so you can relive this memory over and over and over again. So that will be my, you know, favorite part, to have this professionally on, you know, videotape. So you can see the chemistry between the actors.
Yeah, because I just now realized this. It's like you're pointing out about hip hop. I mean, we have things, and we now have hip hop poetry in theater, like Hamilton. We have also hip hop poetry, and there was movies and stuff that were done in hip hop poetry and stuff. Right. So you are taking what's already out there anyway, and doing it so it can be brought to Sacramento, because it's never been brought to Sacramento as much yet.
But add in the acting. So you don't just get to do hip hop. You have to say some lines. So, for example, there's a scene in the courtroom where the young man that in the play thinks he's getting 10 years. And he's like, oh, I'll be out in 10 years. And when the judge gives him 300 years, you know, for what he did, the mom is in the courtroom, Cloudy. And he has to literally face his mother and sing a song to the mother in the courtroom called Mama, I'm Not Coming Home, you know, and has the verses and what. So now you're telling a story with an actor there. So that's the what you don't get in most of the venues.
Oh, okay.
So you're using three talents instead of one. Nice. So expand your repertoire. Makes you more valuable.
Most definitely. Yeah. Most definitely. So this makes it now hard to even ask this question, because now I'm thinking you've done so much stuff in academia and also on stages and other shows. Literally, you know, as I said, there's always the literary poet, and then there's the stage poets, or they call it the page from the stage. Where do you see yourself comfortable in? Do you see yourself comfortable on the stage or on the page or both?
Both. That is a very good question. I spent my first 15 years on the page. And then I realized, as I was doing these venues, they give you what's called the grandpa clause. The new generation was giving me the grandpa clause. So whenever they had shows, I was either the last, well, we're going to let grandpa do some Langston Hughes stuff after we're done partying. And that started to bother me. I was like, wait a minute, I'm not ready to be a grandpa yet. I know some rhymes. And I tell you, here's where this came from. There was an artist on HBO, and he had I was in my sleep, slumber, depression those years. So he was coming to Sacramento. This is on Stockton Boulevard at a theater there. And I saw all of the credits. I said, wow, you know, we get a poetry celebrity coming to Sacramento. So when I got to the venue, I saw how he was like, well, I usually don't come into little places like this, you know. Wow, this guy is just really feeling himself. And he was, you know, sighing when the other poets would perform. Like I have to suffer through this horrible poetry. And I had been in my house for a year working on this piece called Tasha Don't Cry. And this was my, I'll never perform this piece, but I'm in the basement, you're making this monster rhyme scheme. And I knew, and I was like, you know what? I am going to make this guy retire today. And I pulled the monster out. I said, when I get up on this stage and perform this piece that I had been, you know, shaping, and I knew it was a masterpiece. I was just scared to do it. I had never done something like that by memory. And I was terrified. I said, this is the first time that I'm pulling, you know, this thing out of the basement. So I went up on the stage and I performed this song called Tasha Don't Cry. And he was so broken because he had no counter. And so I jumped off the stage and I put, and it was acting in that piece also, rapping and acting. I put the mic in his hand. And the audience was like, you know, what are you going to do since you're insulting us? And he says, I need some more time to prepare. Can somebody else, you know, could go up there? And he was just really like, and so I knew that was my moment to champion other people who were being, and so he created that thing of acting and rapping at the same time. Because I was doing the ambulance sounds myself. I was doing the police. I was just doing the crying. So I was putting all of this in rapping, and people were, what is this, you know, seven personalities? You know, when you start doing your own ambulance sounds, people start to, you know, pay attention to it. So that was the birth of shattering my shyness forever and on a stage. So that was definitely, and that was me listening to Too Much Tupac in all of those years, though. So that was a tribute piece to him.
So you are a real avid on Tupac's legacy, and also that you even have a rhyme tribute to Tupac himself.
Right.
And what's that one called that you?
That would be called Ghetto Rooftops.
Okay. And tell me about, is Tupac been one of those people that you've been championing since his death for such as, I mean, it's now what, 20 something, 30 years, almost getting close to 30 years and stuff.
Right.
And you still resonate from where, before, even while he was alive till now.
Right.
That he was one of the, do you feel like he was one of the greats that just went too soon?
He definitely went too soon, but I studied his lyrics. I analyzed every lyric. I don't care who, at what venue. If you perform, I'm going to study your lyrics. So I study meter, your cadence, your flow. And I started to take his lyrics and put them on paper. And you can't write like that unless you're at a genius level. There's no way. If you look at all of his lines, I count the meter in each line, and you have 11 and a 10 and 11 and a 10. And it's so precise if you break it down, how mathematically, unless you're trying that or you're just innately a genius and it comes out that way. But either way, very few people or rappers could come that close to perfect meter. So that is what impressed me about Tupac. I don't know how his brain worked, but that's why your head bobs at the right time, because it's mathematical. So I saw that in Tupac. And I'll tell you this, since you asked this question, when I was in high school, I came up with this thing called the world's greatest. And I know I was like, who's the world's greatest boxer, the world's greatest basketball player? I had 10 categories. And then I thought about, well, who is the world's greatest poet? And what does that, you know, entitle? What does that mean to be the world's greatest at something? But we automatically say Ali is and Jordan. So we play these games about. So I said, I'm going to write 20 poets on a paper, you know, that I think are the greatest poets in the last 100 to 200 years. And you had Shakespeare, of course, and then Tupac was on that list. I said, I have to put Tupac because for 4 or 5 years, what he accomplished had to be considered, because everyone else had 50 or 60 or 70 years to be considered great. So if he did that in 4 or 5 years, I had to give him that distinction. It was just, very few people had from the age of 18 to that age can pull that off. So as I looked at this list, I said, this is where it got interesting. I looked at that list and watched that list you know, like you watch a snowball. It's like, and then the crazy thought, it's like, what if I was in that number? What would it take to be in that 20? Huh. Who could I, you know, nudge to 21? You know, I don't even mind being 20. But the imagination came in there, like, you know, a little dream to myself, like, wow, you know. And I look at Emily Dickinson and Maya and all of these poets. And I had to study. I said, well, what are their weaknesses? What are their strengths? Half of them are page poets who can't perform at all. Very few are performance poets who do horribly on the page. So, but I'm like, what if a poet had both? Like Tupac is not known for his paperwork, but he's known for his stage work.
Right.
So I wanted to be a poet that could do stage work and paperwork. So that would give me a leg to work on. I said, I got to find, you know, what this one can do. Robert Frost's example was probably one of the best poets on paper, but he had a voice where everybody in the crowd was asleep, you know, when he was reading. So I was like, yes. So that's what I did. I've been studying these poets and for years and taking a part of all of these poets inside of me. So people wonder, why am I so diverse? When you study Tupac and Dickinson and Frost and all of these poets, it gives you the best of all sides. And so the same thing in Maya. It's like she had the grace and the style. So that's what it is. It's having these 20 role models in my private mind to go home every day and, you know. And I even, I would study Sammy Davis. This is how serious I was. I would go on YouTube and I would watch Sammy Davis, not for poetry, but how did he transition from one song to the other? That's, because some poet, next poem, next poem, yeah. Next poem. And I said, I want to be smooth like Sammy. I have to, like, you know, have that. So all of these things from Barbra Streisand, I had to study all of these people who spent time on stage, the rap and all of these things. And when you start mixing it, you get a unique product because you have a piece of all of the great people. So that's where you see a lot of the inspiration.
Wow, that's pretty heavy now I think about it, because the way I always look at poetry, I always look at it from a rapper's perspective before I look at it into a poet's perspective. So it don't, just because I was brought up that way as a kid, that I looked at rap as being the poetry that I resonate to before, and then I changed over to speak to spoken word.
Right.
But I never really thought of it. You're right. I never really thought of the fact of, you gotta look at poetry just like how singers look at songs.
Right.
It's a transition. If you're basically a one singer that's very stagnant, mm-hmm. your audience is gonna be very tired.
Right. Right.
And if you don't change along with the feel of the poem into your transitions aren't very good, it's like a DJ or something.
Right.
You're basically gonna lose a few people because they're gonna just wait for you to end.
Right.
Whatever, maybe even clap. Right. And then wait for your next one as they still sit there. Okay, go next.
A one-trick pony. This is what I always teach poets, your longevity. And I'll tell you, this is another secret. When I write a poem, I usually, you know how in the movies when they have these gun kits and they mix in the different parts together, screwing them together? Most of my poems have three introductions, three in the alternate endings. So I can walk in the crowd, get my little suitcase out, and screw a different intro on the poem, or take this one off, put it back in the kit, and then swap the rear part of it and keep the middle part. So every poem is 10 poems. You know, if you study the mathematics, you can really turn keeping a base and three exits and three beginnings and mix them. The variables give you 7 different poems. So when you walk into a venue, I heard that poem before. Oh, no, you didn't, because now I'm going to sing the beginning. And so it gives you your poems longevity.
It's funny that you point out math. You put a lot of mathematic equations into your statements, because a lot of times I always hear people talk about I'm English, I don't do math, or I do math, I don't do English. Where you basically are combining both sides and saying they both are the same.
Right.
They both help each other. You just need to
find out how to do that.
Right.
Is that one of those things you've learned along the way, or if you just, because I know a lot of English majors don't like math. And just, it kind of confirms me sometimes when people see that as a black and white, like, well, I don't do math. Like, okay, well, let's go. Or I don't do English. Like, okay, well, let's go. Well,
here's another thing. I noticed the car had this thing called 60 RPMs. So again, when I was away from all, I said, what if I could do 60 rhymes per minute? So originally that poem for Tupac was called 60 Rhymes Per Minute. So I sat there in my laboratory, like, I have nothing else to do with my life, so I'm going to make a poem with 60 rhymes a minute. Okay. And so if you hear that poem, I think it starts off with Buster did 30 rhymes a minute, Nas did 44, but 60 rhymes a minute, that's never been done before. So I'm sending this one out to Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur. So that was an alternate beginning. So if I see a hip hop crowd, I'm gonna, you know, throw that culture in there, and they're gonna like, whoa, you know, you're gonna outdo Buster and Nas. And so that was another thing mathematically, if I can count how many rhymes a minute. And I'll just give you a 30-second clip of that. I used to do it when you read it quicker, but when I came in there were older people in the audience, and it was so fast, I said, wow, nobody knew what I said, so I had to slow it down to 40. But the line was like, I thought the light would find you, didn't see the evil night behind you, trying to, you know, bind you. I wanted to remind you I was inclined to, but back then I was blind too. I was so sure that you would endure, lead us with those lyrics, pure and obscure, those clicks, those ticks, those tricks. So anyway, if you keep going at and add 1 minute, there was 60 rhymes in the minute. And it was a 4 or 5 minute piece. And so I could do all that in 4 minutes. And that's when I knew I was obsessed with poetry. I said, I got to stop. Because if they don't get me out this laboratory, I'm going to go nuts in this room and I'll be doing 200 rhymes, speaking a foreign language. But that was just me playing with words. Right. In those off years, I was like, the thing was, I ran into this crash where trying to be Langston, or everybody telling me to be Langston. And after 12 years, that started to get too heavy. And I didn't want to do Harlem poetry, traditional jazz poetry anymore. But I had no B game. That was all that I knew. And it was frustrating to think I'm going to, you know, spend my life people calling me Langston Jr. So that was the transition. That's why the book Goodbye Langston, or Leaving Langston, came into place. I had to experiment with rap to Tupac to get out of the Langston mode. Then I had to find some avenue away from doing 1920, 1930 style of poetry. And how did I know that to find me, to who I was as a poet, I had to leave Langston. So that was the trade-off. And I was like, whoa, I don't know if I have anything else other than Langston. So that was like, ooh. But I had to find, and I did. I started to find styles and that I didn't see before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you tried any of the trap style yet, or you tried even mingling with it or anything?
Yes, this was a Word Wizard project, and I was invited there as a poet, and I'm thinking there's going to be 6 poets. So I go there to the show, and he's a mercy, the urban poet. I'm like, where are the poets? Where are the other poets? And I'm thinking I'm going to open the show and exit. Good night. And someone decided to put me in the middle of the show.
Oh.
After the party has started. You know, when the party has started, everybody's drinks are pouring.
Right.
And so I have to go tell all of these people, okay, you guys are going to have to stop having fun for about 10 minutes to let me do. And, you know, you can get in trouble like that, because they was getting down and getting up and getting sideways.
Right.
So I was like, okay, this is not going to be fun or easy.
Right.
And the host wasn't really helping me. He was like, hey, you're the mic.
Own. Yeah.
Like, hello, everybody. You know, like, you know, it's like stopping a J. Cole concert.
Yes.
to read a speech, you know. So when I did that piece, I had to be creative. I said, okay, this is, you know, I got to go back into the database. I'm from South Central, so I know how to, you know, do what I did. And it turned out to be a big hit, you know, on a rap stage. You know, people were coming after the show and like, whoa, how? You know, the other performers and, you know, when, how, and show me. So that's the beauty of being flexible like that. I'm like, if I can pull that off, because I was like, this is, I don't know about this one. You know, I've done it's a keynote poet can perform anywhere.
Right.
But this is not what I meant, you know, when you you got
to
go.
You technically prove what you're worth. Right. You trade for the word.
So doing a lot of nightclub, and then I have the, I don't know why I'm mentioning this on air, but the R&B Rick James Fire and Desire song, which is, and I did it as a poem, but when you start to perform, that's where Rick James, you're going to have women like, hi, me. No, you guys are totally misunderstanding this. This is poetry. But you can even turn poetry into R&B and rhyme the words. And so I'm learning all of these styles to come up with Have You Seen Her and kind of interchange the poetry where they had lyrics, but the poetry. So that's another genre, you know, the R&B poetry, the theater poetry. I don't care. Anything that you put in front of me, I'm going to find a way to rhyme it. So, and it's almost like, and I think this is an OCD thing, maybe happened in childhood. I don't know, something hit me on the head or a cereal box fell on me. Because one time somebody asked me to design funeral cards. And it rhymed. It was like everything. It was like the big card and it rhymed. Can you do this? Can you rhyme an obituary? You know, so even my high school yearbook, I rhyme. So that was just my my illness is rhyming. I'm just, you know. So when I did the novel, I paid $1,000 for someone to edit it. And they said, well, you're going to have to take this out of rhymes and put it back into standard, you know, English. I said, oh, I don't know how. It's 265 pages of rhyming and you want me to unrhyme it. So that was the challenge, and I was like, and so I tried to find somebody, my daughter, like, hey, you got a degree in writing. Can you, like, put this in prose for me? She said, I'm not doing it for you. I was like, come on. I can make some money. Just fix it. So I eventually stuck to the rhymes, and to me, I looked at, tried to do research on the first rhyming novel. Has there ever been a rhyming novel? And I went through Google several days trying to find one, and I didn't find one like that. They have a different kind of rhyming novel, but you have to be really obsessed to write a 265 page rhyming novel. I mean, that with characters and setting in a standard of a novel where people don't even know it's rhyming.
Right.
After 20 pages, they said, is this rhyming? that's several people say that. So that was a shock, because now I can be a novelist again out of the Langston Hughes box. I was so afraid of that box. So now I can do the novel and open up other doors.
And the novel was leaving Langston, right?
The novel was Dear Oprah.
Oh, Dear Oprah. Okay, yes.
Which is a woman's novel, in my opinion. So that was shocking for, can a male write a woman's intimate novel like that? Well, subject matter. You know, what are the historical comparisons? Or can a guy even get away with that, talking about very, intimate women's body issues and stuff? So that was, more insanity. I was like, I got to get some therapy. I got to go to Kaiser. This is not, And as soon as the novel was done, I'm like, theater, So it's like I'm running from one success, like the Pac-Man.
Right.
Let's try theater.
Yeah.
And it's funny, though, because they all work. And that's the scary part. I'm trying to find something that doesn't work in writing so I can, have this excuse. So teaching poetry, I'm like, it worked. I'm like, this is not normal. I need help, therapy. So it is scary at times when you never fall in love with one thing. You run to the next.
Right.
And the next. And so one day you have to come and to terms with all of whatever you've done. You're just painting one house after the other down the street and you're just not staying there for the claps. Where did he go? Huh? maybe he's doing children's books now.
You ever thought about doing children's
I have books? Won an award doing children's books as well.
Nice.
At Sac State University. So, yeah. And when I say 12 genres, I've been through the spectrum of it, probably trying to find something that I can't do, and that's almost like a goal. Like, I gotta find something that stops me, and I'll find it, I'm sure. But I'm still in that mix.
So how do you feel about being a director for a play?
That was, I tell you, the first shock of that is I was directing Cloudy, and it was a scene where she was a black mother, and she had to tell her son to get up and go find a job. So I'm standing there, and she's like, pretty much, get up and go get a job. I said, no, Cloudy, like a black mama, like a real, like, and so I'm trying to, give directions on how black mamas tell you to get your butt, up out of this house. I said, they even kick you too.
Yeah.
They throw water on you and they be, I said, we all got some, black mamas. So
I used to get the wet white squad.
Yeah, especially if you're 25 and you laying on your mama's couch, might get that couch tipped over or something. She ain't gonna say, can you please get up and go get a job because the rent is due? You're gonna get something, So, watching her transform in an hour to where she was like, oh, I like this. I can be aggressive. So they were going at it after a while. And so that was the beauty of directing, to see the transformation of giving those stage directions. So, and it's a challenge. I want people to know that we are poets doing acting, not actors doing poetry. So it's going to be poetry to the third power, so to speak, not acting to the minus power or something like that. So it will be enhanced poetry, but you'll get a different experience from it because I give the young actors credit because they put their heart into something that they've never done before. So, but the story is powerful, and I think that's the point of it. If the story is told and you cry and you clap, and you might not be Denzel or Holly up there, but I think any poet that goes that far out of their element, comfort zone, to be brave enough to hang out with me, because if you're around me, you're getting challenged. Especially poor Jabri, like, oh, Mr. Miller, what next? we don't do average. We do stuff like Evel Knievel. We jumping off a building, or we going to flip. And that's the fun part, because I will get bored if it's just, ho-hum, ho-hum, ho-hum. I mean, and I'd rather fail doing something exciting than succeed doing something where everybody is asleep. And even if you screw up the greatest effort, the audience will like it more than they'll be laughing, as opposed to falling asleep. So give me a play where nobody falls asleep, and it's successful. So, but that's the worst thing that can happen when you put your audience to sleep. If they're laughing, they don't know if it's a drama or a comedy. You're like, true. Oh, wow, well, this is a comedy,
That's true. That's
good
true.
Comedy, you can fake that. But when people start yawning and walking out, then you didn't do your work. So that's the one thing we guarantee, some excitement.
Okay.
And one way or the other, you're going to talk about that show somewhere at some time.
So why don't you give the audience the name of the show and when they should go and when it be out, and also if they can get tickets still.
The name of the show is When I Get Free. And what happens is three of us have tickets remaining. Mine are sold out. Ube, Jabri, and a few others have tickets. So, yes, there are tickets available. But I think the number is under 12 for all of us. So if you contact me, I can contact the other actors, or you can contact the other actors to get tickets. But Tyler Perry, when he told me that, when I read that his first play, there was nobody there, and they put all of this money and had all of this work in it. And I said, wow, I won't have one person in my first play, so
nice.
I'm already ahead of Tyler Perry. He was like, I did all that work, and there wasn't nobody there. And so we just had to do the show with the cast, and so thought about that. And so to even come near selling out your first play is a milestone in itself. I was like, it was actually running out of tickets before I even realized, wait a minute, am I actually doing this feat? And there's no way I'm pulling this off. So that was the thing of, you know, getting the people in those seats. And I'm just happy more for the younger people, especially like Cloudy, who's just starting out, because some people don't get these opportunities until they're 40. But out the gate, if you're like that age and you have a vision now of how a stage works, the sky is your limit. All of my stuff came after 40. So the first 20 years was all, you know, the Langston Hughes paper stuff. So this is an exciting era for young people to do the spectacular, because art has to be reinvented. There has to be a new renaissance somewhere, or the change that we're looking for, it won't happen. You know, if you go through history, whether it's the Harlem Renaissance or the Civil Rights Arts Movement, you're not getting the laws changed unless there's an arts movement somewhere involved in. A lot of people don't realize this. Politicians don't just change stuff. There has to be a change in the culture. Yeah, for people, movies come out and plays and the art changes. And that's when the culture itself changes.
That's When I Get Free over at the Uli Theater. That's off 26th and T.
28th and T Street. 2007 28th Street.
Okay. And that'll be on February 8th.
At 7:30 we start. Doors open at 7 p.m.
I'm telling you, people, get your tickets. Come see this. Even if you're a purist, a theater purist, or a poet fanatic, I think this is time for us to see something different in our poetry community. And I'm glad that my man, Mike Ellis, M.E., the incredible poet, is basically in the forefront.
Oh, my alter ego. Yeah, incredible. Keeps me out of a lot of trouble. So when I need to hide, I'll switch costumes and I'll be incredible, or then I'll go back to the invisible academic poet. So it's kind of good that when the pressure bears from one part of society on one side, I'm not locked in. I can disappear into the other side like the Pac-Man game. I'm like,
he's gone.
Where did he go? You know, I'll be back here in 2 years. You guys can get me, but I'm going over here on this side. So, oh, I will tell you this, because of that book, Dear Oprah, I was asked to teach this year in India, which is on a panel. So I was not releasing that book until August because I wasn't ready. I didn't have the marketing and all of that. So already I have 3 book signings and 2 interviews. It almost jumped off of the shelf by itself to pull me. I am not pulling it. I was like, I'm not August. So that book is getting breath already. And I was trying to hold off to do the play. And then another book was released yesterday, which is The Leaving Langston. I just got a copy of it. So that's 3 things pretty much at once to try to market. And that is the ultimate challenge to do. Like tonight we'll do poetry. So, yeah, I have to really step up my game to be more ready and willing. You got 3 times the amount of rehearsal. You got to really, you know, it's like playing baseball, basketball, and football. You got to be there and show up for all the events. So, you know, that's the new frontier. And I hope it inspires other poets, and it does, that people say, does poetry make money? And I said, well, Maya made $3.5 million a year in her final year. So somebody made some money doing poetry. So the possibility is out there. I said, and Dr. Seuss has more money than Jay-Z. I said, Dr. Seuss is a billionaire who could buy Jay-Z, so I'm sure, you know, so I'm like the champion of poetry. Don't give up on poetry. You know, some people have, you know, worked poetry very effectively. And I also say that poetry is, what, several thousand years old, whereas the other art form is 30 or 40. So you got to look at the longevity, you know, in history, that poetry has been here for, and in every country on earth. So it bothers me sometimes that poetry gets diminished. So I have to, you know, champion for people to hold on and stop thinking that poetry is going to die because of other music forms kind of take their 50-year break into it. Yeah. But the poetry is the one that's consistent. Yeah. It never dies because it's for old, young, every, you know, country. So that's my thing, to get on people's nerves, that poetry is not dying. So that's why I did the novel. Like, now take that for the next 100 years. So somebody's, nice. You know, I'm going to keep throwing something in the paint until people stop pushing us around, because it gets frustrating. Oh, you're just one of those, like, trying to get a date. What do you do? I'm a poet. like a poet? Yeah, a poet. Like, you do rhymes? A poet. You know, it's almost like, oh, that's cute. No, it's not cute. I don't, you know, when you say rapper, oh, wow, you rap. You know, you get a different thing. And so that, don't, you know, belittle me for my occupation. I'm a great poet. So that's my thing. I'm like, I have to put that ego out there, not just for me, but for other people. Like, don't just let them throw sand in your face.
Yeah.
Stand up and go face the bully.
Yeah.
Because they will bully you if you're a poet these days. And a lot of poets quit. Like, I can't do it anymore.
I can't. It's easy way out.
Yeah, they're throwing sand on me. So that's what you'll see me here. I'm always trying to equalize the culture, because I think you can do a lot with poetry.
So where can they find your work and find you on the social media? Where can they find you and stuff?
That's kind of interesting. I'm just getting to that point where I need to be found. But Keynote Poets of Sacramento is also, if you can remember Keynotes, then you can Google, put that in the Facebook bar, and you'll find me there. I'm Michael Ellis on Facebook as well, under my name, and Incredible on Instagram. It just pop up, Incredible Poet, I-N-K, Incredible Poet. So that's it, and I think I'm getting to a point where I want to be found. I had spent all my life not wanting to be found, so I'm going to start finding people nowadays. So I'll be a lot easier to find. But a lot of people, like I said, are from the Philippines, from Africa. And it got to a point where it was scary. It was like, you know, wait a minute. This is getting to be international and not local. Because when I left high school, they said, you're going to be a black poet. I said, whoa, you know, well, not a poet? No, not a poet, a black poet. Not a poet, you know. So that was almost my other beef. Like, well, what is a black poet, and why isn't a black poet not a poet? Well, it kind of is, but it's different. You're an urban poet. You're a good, but you're not. You know. So that was always my other battle. I don't like being dissed like that. So when I get on the stage, you're not gonna diminish me with a dash, even though I like being a black poet. I'm not going to let anybody use that as, you know, the stepchild, you know. So that's me. That's my other war side, that I have to fight for these little things they throw in the universe, you know. So that's it. I always say that no matter where you go as a poet, and that's the same thing I would say with a basketball player. You don't see black basketball player for LeBron James. Ooh, the black basketball player scored 80 points tonight. It's like, no, he's a basketball player now, because that's the NBA. And I want poetry to have that, you know, that same stipulation, you know. So, and I don't need anybody else to tell me what color I am, because I'm well aware of it. I get it. You know, at my age, I think I've figured out, you know, what color I am. So that's another thing that I have to put out there, that I'm a poet, and then you can determine the other dynamics that you want to put on there. You can call me anything else you want, but put poet first, not, you know, black dash poet or poet dash black. However you do it, put the poet first. You can put the black in parentheses or in hyphens or wherever you want to put it, but put poet first. So that's my testimony right there.
And I think that's a good thing to end off on.
Yeah.
Oh, most definitely. Well, thank you, Mike, for coming out and or Emmy or Incredible. You know what? I'm just calling you Michael.
I'll take it. I got to figure this out too, Michael Ellis.
And everyone else, you can find Iambic Poetry on iambic.podbeam.com, or you can find us on Facebook under at Iambic Mag. That's IAMBIC. Or you also can find us on Twitter on the Iambic Zine, and also on Blogspot or Blogger at Iambic Zine. I want to thank you to Michael, and we'll see y'all later. All right, peace.